Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for September 4, 2003. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. We've got three segments scheduled for tonight. First, we'll be speaking to Laura Smith, who is the president of Local 35, one of the unions that's striking at Yale University. We'll talk to her about the strike and what an evil employer that very rich institution is. One of the things they're doing is contracting out for some janitorial services. They already pay their janitors next to nothing, but they want to pay even closer to nothing. So we'll talk to Laura Smith about Yale's practices and the workers' fights against them. Then about 20 after or so, we'll speak with Heather Boucher, an economist for the Center of Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., about a report that she just did on how jobs held by former welfare recipients hit hard by the economic downturn, the very kinds of jobs that poor women who were kicked off welfare were supposed to be taking have been among those that disappeared most rapidly in the recent or current recession. And then finally, at about 20 of 6, we'll speak with Sharon Bader, who is an Australian, and she is joining us at an ungodly early hour in Australia at this about 5:40, which is, I think, 7:40 Australian time in the Friday morning. She's the author of a book called Power Play, The Fight to Control the World's Electricity, just published by the New Press. And with Enron in the news last year and with a blackout in the United States in the news a couple of weeks ago, here's some historical and political background to the experiment in electricity privatization and deregulation. Experiments that have occurred not only in the United States, but around the world. But before we get to these segments, first a few words about the current economic news. And I'm going to focus. I know I said I would be talking about the rest of the world, but I can't kick the habit of talking about the U.S. I swear I'll talk about the rest of the world next week. But the big story in the economic news these days is whether the United States economy is recovering, and if so, if that recovery is actually accelerating. And most of the economic reports that have come out in recent weeks have been surprises to the upside. They continue to be, most of them, with few exceptions, stronger than expected. This morning, for example, it was reported that chain store sales, sales by department stores and such, other chain stores, rose 5% on a year-to-year basis, a very strong performance, the best in 14 months, although the performance is led by discount operations like wholesale clubs and discount stores. So a lot of price pressure, which means that consumers may be getting a good deal, but retailers and manufacturers are not finding very big profits. So how long this expansion may be sustained if it's not profitable is a major economic question. Also, vehicle sales, automobile sales, very, very, very strong. It was also reported this morning, selling at an almost 19 million annual rate in August last month. Very, very strong performance. And again, the automakers have been offering 0% financing, so they're not making much money on these sales, but consumers are getting a great deal, not paying any interest. But they are racking up the debt, and that's the story throughout the U.S. economy as well. But so people are buying stuff. We're seeing strong vehicle sales, strong retail sales, and strong consumption in general. The Federal Reserve's Beige Book, which is an anecdotal report on economic conditions around the country, which is released every 6 weeks or so just before a Federal Reserve policy meeting, that was released yesterday, and that reported broad improvements, broad strengthening in the U.S. economy. 11 of the 12 Federal Reserve districts are reporting to headquarters that economic conditions were improving in their neck of the woods and throughout July and August. Only the Dallas district was an exception, but 11 of the 12 districts are showing an improvement. The blackout, they reported, seems to have no economic effect of any consequence, although it should have political effect if all goes well. Number of sectors of the economy were showing strength. The only real exception, as it continues to be, was the labor markets. We're seeing very weak wage increases and very weak hiring going on among employers. So that is the last piece of the economic puzzle to fall into place, assuming this economic recovery story is going to succeed. We need expanding employment if we're going to have the recovery sustain and accelerate. So this is the big if. There is some strength in temporary employment hiring, which historically has been a harbinger of broader employment growth, but also maybe that employers have just made a permanent shift towards hiring permanent temporary workers rather than permanent ones, and so maybe the indicator isn't as much of a promising one as it used to be. And along those lines, the weekly total of initial claims for unemployment insurance, that is the people who've just lost their jobs and report for the first time to the unemployment office to sign up for benefits, the number of those rose last week to 413,000, a pretty substantial rise from the previous week, and the second consecutive weekly rise after a nice downtrend that took hold in the spring and continued throughout the summer. We have to see whether this is just a blip or this is actually a sign of weakening, because there are many other signs that the labor markets have been at least stabilizing, if not about to turn around and start growing. Tomorrow morning brings the release of the monthly employment numbers. The employment and unemployment figures will be released tomorrow morning at 8:30. I'm expecting to see about a flat report in most respects, which, after six consecutive months of job losses totaling almost 500,000, a flat report would be good news. So we'll have to see what happens tomorrow morning, but that's what's likely. And finally, a couple of indexes that surveys done by the Institute for Supply Management, which is used to be known as the National Association of Purchasing Managers. These are the people who buy things for large corporations, and they're very much in touch with the state of business at their employers. And they have two surveys. One, a survey of manufacturers that's been done for a long, long time, going back, I think, to the 1940s. So this has a very long track record and is a very good read on what's going on in the manufacturing sector. It's now strengthened for the fourth consecutive month. And again, all components seem to be strong except employment. Actually, the employment component weakened, and it looks like employment in the manufacturing industry continues to shrink. And then the ISM recently, a few years ago, started doing a survey of non-manufacturing firms, mostly service industry firms. This doesn't have a very long track record, so we don't know how good it is, but we can extrapolate from the manufacturing one, which is pretty good. And it shows the service sector of the U.S. economy also accelerating, strengthening. And even there, the employment component finally went positive for the first time. Actually, it's been positive for a couple of months, but it rose even higher. So we now are seeing some signs of employment growth in services and also a pretty strong demand for service industry, service industries. So that looks like at least that part of the economic recovery is on track. So what we're really waiting for is some sign of the job market recovering. And as I said last week, it seems that there's a lot of structural change in this recession. It wasn't really just a business cycle. There are a lot of employers didn't just lay people off with the assumption that they'd be recalled when better times returned. They laid people off forever, and they're not being recalled, and employers are not doing an awful lot of new hiring. So it's going to be a lot more difficult to get the job roles expanding once again. But if they don't start expanding once again, then this incipient recovery will derail itself, and we'll be back in the mud again. So we'll keep an eye on all these things in the coming weeks. And now we're joined by, is it Michael Denning we've got? Michael Denning, we can't raise our picketing Yale worker, though. We're not having any success in getting her on the cell phone, but we do have Michael Denning on the line, who is a professor at Yale, author of The Cultural Front, a book that came out from Verso a few years ago, and a signer of a letter urging the administration of Yale to submit to some kind of binding arbitration. Welcome to WBAI, Michael. I can barely hear you.
Hi, Doug. I'm good. How are you?
Good. There you are. Thanks for joining us. We don't have our striking worker on the line, so I was hoping she could explain some of the issues in the strike. But just give us the rundown. What's going on at Yale, and what kind of employer is Yale University?
Okay. Well, I'll start. the basic things that I guess last Wednesday, the 27th, the Union of the Clerical and Technical Employees and the Union of the Building and Maintenance and Service and Dining Hall Employees are two locals of HERE, both went on strike the first day that the Yale students came in. And so I guess what day are we at now? Wednesday, Thursday, a week later, the strike continues. The main issues, I guess, are the contract expired, I think it was in January of 2002. It's about 18 months ago. In fact, there was negotiations before that. So it's been a long time since the negotiations have gone on and have broken down essentially over some wage issues, including the issue of retroactive pay, going so that the raises that come in with the new contract would go back to when the old contract ended. That's still up in the air. Issues of job security, which have been a long-term issue here at Yale, the university's continued desire and implementation of subcontracting out what are union jobs and what looks to most people in the union, and I think many people observers of this, as an attempt to reduce over the long term the number of unionized faculty as much as possible. And then I think the third and most explosive issue right now is over pensions and an attempt to get really a living wage pension for people who have worked all their life for Yale. Yale is basically the company in a company town. It's the largest employer by a long way between the university, which I think has somewhere between 9,000 and 10,000 employees, and the hospital, which adds another 5,000. And so it really is a dominant institution in New Haven. And I think that the tendency that what Yale has tried to do for both its non-academic and academic staff is to create a two-tier labor force where there would be a small number of, on the academic side, tenured faculty, and on the non-academic side, union workers with benefits, and that would be a small number and ever getting smaller, and then a much larger number of subcontracted, casual, flexible workers. And I think the unions have really stood up to kind of challenge that and maintain wages and benefits for everybody who works at the university.
And we should emphasize this is a very, very rich university with an endowment worth about $11 billion that can't really plead poverty.
Yeah, that is not the case at all. Figures have been dropped about them making $15 million a day on their endowment. I'm not sure. I haven't looked at the exact numbers, but it doesn't get challenged too much.
Yeah, and the endowment is actually one of the great cornucopias of investment returns in the United States. It's got a tremendous, tremendous performance record over whatever period you want to look at, from 1 year to 20 years. It's really greatly outperformed the market. So this is an institution with plenty of money to spare. It just doesn't want to share it with its workers. It also has a long history of very confrontational labor relations, right?
Yeah, that goes back. It goes way back. There was actually 30s confrontations, but really the modern one goes back to the late 60s and early 1970s when there was a series of battles essentially every 3 years when contracts came up with the service and maintenance and dining hall workers who organized first. And there were a series of really bitter battles that intersected with the civil rights movement, in particular in New Haven. At one point, the dining hall and service workers in New Haven were laid off for the entire summer, and so went on welfare and collected welfare checks in the summer because they only were given 9-month jobs at Yale. Around the late 70s and early 80s, local 35 of HERE, decided they needed allies, and they put a lot of energy behind the organizing of clerical and technical workers at Yale, and that struggle, which led to a very long strike for recognition in 1984, is really, I think, rightly regarded as a major struggle for women workers. It was fought over the demand for comparable worth, which has not been won, but which the unions have fought for in each contract to increase that And that really set the stage for the present moment. Through the 90s, those two unions, both of which have been recognized and had contracts, have put their solidarity behind the organizing of graduate teachers into a union, GISO, which was one of the earliest, if you still unrecognized, graduate teacher unions, and more recently behind a several-year campaign of 1199 to organize hospital workers at the Yale New Haven Hospital. So there's really four unions that now make up the Federation of Hospital and University Employees. And I forget what the figures were, but it's something like in the last 10 contracts, only two have been settled without a strike.
And we're just about out of time, but this is more in a lot of ways than this. I went to Yale and I had many ways a good time there, but I love to embarrass the institution whenever possible. So that's part of the reason why I want to do this this segment, because it's a very rich institution that behaves very disgracefully. But it's also, in a lot of ways, this strike is symbolic of a whole lot of labor relations in the United States. We've got so-called knowledge workers. We've got very low-wage clerical and maintenance workers. We've got hospital workers. This really is, in many ways, a microcosm of the U.S. Service economy these days, and unions are really fighting either get their foot in the door there or maintain whatever influence they have in that sector. So how does this shape up as a symbolic strike in that sense?
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And I must say, I also like to embarrass Yale, and over 100 faculty members have taken their classes off campus, respecting the picket lines in order to bring that attention. But I think in some ways the story is less about Yale than it is about the really spectacular kind of alliance that's been put together by the Yale unions in connection with community groups, in reviving tactics of civil disobedience, in making connections with a number of church groups, community groups all around the city, across the divide, which is a central one in New Haven, of the city and the suburbs. And, of course, Yale workers live on both sides of that divide. Yale workers are black, white, Latino. And so I think that one of the reasons why this has been such a focal point and a trigger point is that these unions have asked for more. It is a kind of social movement unionism, and have not settled for, okay, we'll get benefits and good wages for the few people that are unionized, and then allow you to basically turn over the rest of it to a non-union thing. And from that, I think it's really important and marks a kind of the unions involved, both SEIU and HERE, have been unions that have really pushed the AFL-CIO toward a kind of more organizing stance. And so I think a lot of people are watching this and counting on it.
All right, well, good luck, and convey my best wishes to the strikers if you run into some. Thanks.
I will.
Thanks for joining us, Michael Michael Denning. Michael Denning is a professor at Yale and the author of many books, including The Cultural Front, which was published a few years by Verso, about the popular front culture of the 1930s. And we'll be back in just a moment after this musical word from Neutral Milk Hotel. was a bit from Neutral Milk Hotel, the song Communist Daughter. And a word about the music on this show. Sometimes it bears some relation to the content, sometimes it bears none at all. And but if I hear another strumming folky singing political lyrics badly, then I think I may scream. So you're never going to hear that kind of music on this show. You know, sometimes you need a little contradiction, productive contradiction. That's the dialectic moving onward. Now we're joined by the economist Heather Boucher, who is with the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., and is the lead author of a briefing paper just published by CEPR, Jobs Held by Former Welfare Recipients Hit Hard by the Economic Downturn. Welcome to WBAI, Heather.
Good afternoon, Doug. Nice to be here.
Thanks always for joining us. So the great promise of welfare reform was that there was, you know, the American economy produces tons of low-wage jobs, and it was welfare reform was going to deliver poor women into those jobs, and they were going to become good functioning employees. How have things turned out?
Well, unfortunately, the economy hasn't cooperated as much as we would have liked over the past couple of years. You know, unemployment has been rising for nearly 3 years now, and many of the sectors of the economy that have been hit hardest by rising unemployment and job losses are the same industries that many welfare recipients had found employment in. So whereas the overall economy has been losing jobs at about an annual rate of 1.9%, many of the industries that welfare recipients found jobs in have been losing more jobs. For example, temporary help, where many former welfare recipients found jobs, has been losing jobs at 5.5% since the start of the most recent recession.
Well, we've heard that this has been a mild recession with relatively mild job loss. Is this sector of the economy been hit a lot harder?
Yes, these sectors have been. They haven't been, not all of them have been hit harder, but certainly quite a number of them have been. Most welfare recipients are employed in service sector jobs. They're concentrated in retail trade, in food services, temporary help, home health care, things like that. And these sectors have been losing more jobs than the overall economy. So they have been hit hard. And then importantly, many of these sectors, we've also seen more slower wage growth in these sectors than we've been seeing in the overall economy. So they've been losing more jobs, and there have been greater declines in slows in wage growth in those sectors than compared to the overall economy.
Well, the wage problem, is that in part because there are so many former welfare recipients trying to get jobs that it's forcing the wages down?
It's partly a competition issue, and partially that these are jobs at the low end of the labor market. So when you've seen, I mean, as we've seen now, unemployment has been, like I said, rising for almost 3 years now, and you've seen a lot of folks that had been laid off are now competing for these jobs along with the former welfare recipients. So somebody gets laid off in manufacturing, or they get laid off in some other part of the economy, then you just have more competition for these low-end service sector jobs.
What do we know about the fate of former welfare recipients? I know there was a spate of studies over the last few years, but there was really, didn't seem like any definitive picture. What do we know, what's happened to people who've seen their welfare checks stopped?
Well, we know that over the late 1990s, about 60% of former welfare recipients found jobs at some point, and we haven't seen a great deal of research that's looked at exactly what's happened to former welfare recipients in the 2000s, just because of the nature of because of the nature of the research, quite frankly, it's hard to look at what's happened to folks who left welfare in 96 all the way in 2002. But we do know that most of them found work at some point, but that they were much more likely to lose their jobs in the recession. They're far less likely than other workers to be eligible to meet the monetary eligibility requirements for unemployment insurance if they do lose those jobs that they found relative to other workers. And we're starting to see indications that poverty is rising again, especially among households that look like welfare families, households headed by a single mom with kids under the age of 18. So all signs are pointing to things not being as good for this population as they had been during the boom of the late 1990s.
Yeah, we heard a lot of stories in 1998, 1999 about what a great success welfare reform was, but we're not hearing too much lately.
No, they don't really want us to be talking about it now because things aren't looking as good. And we're just seeing more and more low-wage service sector workers out of work. And importantly, one of the other things to bear in mind is that this recession hit women harder than previous recessions had hit women. A lot of that was because so many more women were in the workplace, but especially so many more low-wage women, women who hadn't previously been working or former welfare recipients had joined the labor market. And compared to previous recessions, women had been, they'd lost more employment than previous recessions and saw their unemployment grow more. So I think there's a lot of signs pointing to this recession being especially hard for women relative to previous recessions and especially for women, single women, heads of families.
And that's partly because of some of the sectors that were hit so hard, right? The eating and drinking places and retail establishments where women are disproportionately employed. In contrast to previous recessions, well, manufacturing has done very badly in this downturn, but male manufacturing workers usually bore the brunt of earlier business cycles. And
exactly. I've been thinking of this as an equality of employment in the boom has led to more of an equality of unemployment in the downturn, and that's certainly what we've been seeing.
That's not really the kind of progress we're looking for, is it?
Well, yeah, no, probably not, but that certainly has been the case.
I'm speaking with the economist Heather Boucher, who's with the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., and you can find them on the web at cepr.net. I got that right?
Yes, you did.
CEPR.net. And this is WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM, and on the web at WBAI.org. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. And the legislation that created welfare reform created something called Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, TANF, and this is up for reauthorization this year. So what's happening with TANF reauthorization?
Well, what's happening is not that much and a lot all at the same time. On the one hand, the welfare reform bill that was passed in 1996 had a 5-year limit on it, that it had to be reauthorized by Congress. The funding had to be reauthorized in 5 years, which was last year. And there's a lot of work that went into a lot of advocates and a lot of research was gearing up for thinking about what needed to be done for this welfare reauthorization. But what ended up happening is that welfare reform wasn't reauthorized last year. They just extended it for a year so that we are now looking at having to reauthorize it this year. And, in fact, the deadline is September 30th. What happened this year is that the House passed a welfare reauthorization bill back in February, but the Senate hasn't passed a bill because the Democrats and the Republicans on the Senate Finance Committee have not been able to come up with something that they can both agree on. And so it seems that things are really stalled in the Senate, and all indications are that they will probably just extend the welfare reform bill for another year or perhaps a shorter period of time. There's been some Hill gossip that has been passing around that perhaps the Republicans want us to do the reauthorization extension in 3-month increments, but hopefully they'll do it either for a year or two. But the long and the short of this is that it keeps a lot of us here in Washington focused on these reauthorization moments rather than all the other kinds of policy issues that are out there. So it's in some ways keeping people busy and not focusing on Medicaid or other income support programs.
That's clever. Clever.
It's very clever, and it's very frustrating from our perspective, actually. So there you go.
But is any of the kind of information you've been talking about, the effects of the recession on the employment of welfare reform victims, has this entered into the congressional debate at all, as far as you can see?
Well, it certainly did not in any serious way enter in the House debates. The House bill that passed in February was more draconian than the bill that was passed in 1996, requiring increased hours of work for welfare recipients, primarily as regards to this conversation, where we're at a moment when unemployment is rising, hours of work are declining, have actually been stagnant for the economy overall, and yet this is the moment when the House Republicans passed a bill that increases the requirements for folks on welfare. It certainly doesn't make sense, given what's going on in the economy overall. At the same time, they have done nothing to increase the amount of money available for child care for former welfare recipients. So for those who are working, there just isn't the availability of funds in this bill to help them find the child care that they need. So there's been a real lack of consistency between what's been going on in the economy, and especially the low-wage economy, and what kind of bill House Republicans passed. And this is the battleground that's been going on in the Senate, where the Senate Democrats have been saying, we need to be thinking about what's going on and how realistic our expectations are in terms of former welfare recipients. If unemployment's at 6.4%, it's obviously a little bit more difficult for them to find work than it was back in 1998.
And you alluded to this earlier. You said that poverty was rising. There was a report out of the Census Bureau the other day saying that the poverty rate rose last year. Not much of a surprise, but could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, there was a report that just came out from the Census Bureau that said that the poverty rate increased to 12.4%, an increase of 1.3 million individuals. And this is a new data series that the Census is being put together called the American Community Survey. Generally, when we look to the official poverty rate, it's from a survey called the Current Population Survey that comes out at the end of September. We will be getting those numbers in a few weeks. But this is a new survey that the Census is trying to implement, and it's been trying to get fully funded. So that's where that came out. And, of course, it's expected that poverty would go up given what we've been seeing in the labor market, that so many more people are unemployed and that incomes have been falling. So that does make sense.
Any sense on who was getting poorer, or do we not have that level of detail?
Well, the level of detail is not as great as we would like it, but I can tell you that it does appear that I took a look at female householders, the proportion of female households headed by a single woman that increased their poverty rate, and those numbers went up by 150,000 over the past year, according to this survey. So it's up to nearly 3.4 million of those families. But other than that, the detail, I really couldn't speak that much more to it.
Well, we'll look at the end of the month when the official big poverty numbers come out.
We'll exactly.
Slice those every way we want to. So I think we're just about out of time. So thanks for joining us, Heather.
Thank you so much, Doug.
Heather Boucher is an economist with the Center for Economic and Policy Research based in Washington, D.C. And a word about that U.S. poverty line. It's a very, very strange thing. It was put together in the early 1960s on the basis of 1950s research. And that 1950s research, it was based on two things. One, the average family spent a third of its income on food back then. And so what the researchers did was put together a very, very minimal food budget, something you're not really intended to live on for any length of time, but just somebody on hard times could live on this emergency food budget. Well, they figured, since the average family spent a third of its income on food, let's just multiply the cost of this minimal food budget by 3, and that will give us a poverty rate and a poverty line. And that's what they did. And the number has been just adjusted for inflation ever since. So in concept, the poverty line of 1960 is exactly the same in purchasing power as the poverty line of 2002 or 2003, even though average incomes in the broader economy have risen very, very greatly. So this is an extremely minimal standard for judging poverty, and even by that standard, over 12% of American households are poor, and they would be poor if based on 1960s standards. So this is really a scandalous thing. A more honest version of the poverty line would come up with a rate that was considerably higher, more in the range of 20 to 25%. And again, we'll be back to speak with Sharon Bader, author of Power Play, after another word from Neutral Milk Hotel.
2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
was a bit of Neutral Milk Hotel's song Holland 1945. Neutral Milk Hotel, a star of the great 90s indie rock fluorescence. And we're taking a little journey back into the past. I think that was 1998, that song. And now we're joined by Sharon Bader, who is the author of Power Play, The Fight to Control the World's Electricity, just published by the New Press. And she teaches at the University of Wollongong in Australia and joins us at a rather early hour in her part of the world. Thank you for joining us, Sharon Bader.
Good afternoon there.
Thanks for welcome to the air. And I think this is your second time on this show. We had you talking about public relations and environment a few years ago.
That's right, yes.
And now you've got this very informative book on electricity, privatization and deregulation, rather timely given the blackouts in California a couple of years ago and the blackouts in the northeastern part of the United States just a couple of weeks ago, which preempted this program. But this is an issue. The whole deregulation and privatization of electricity is something that's an issue around the world and something with quite a long history. And your book is a lot about that. So let's first start talking about, in the United States, the fight over electricity going back to the early part of this century. Review the history of how we ended up, first of all, with this regulated power system in the U.S. In the years after World War II that has gradually been deregulated.
Well, originally there was quite a bit of competition between private and municipal electricity supply, and private companies were very keen to see municipal companies disappear because they showed them up. Municipal companies inevitably provided the electricity at cheaper rates and more reliably. So it was very much a threat, and because during the earlier part of last century the private electricity companies grew and merged and became huge holding companies, people were very much aware of the way they exploited the electricity companies within the holding companies, and so there was very much a push for regulation and public control of these companies.
Those power conglomerates you're talking about were big stars in the 1920s stock market speculation, right?
Yes, that's right. A couple of the very big ones, like Sam Insull's conglomerate, crashed quite spectacularly at the beginning of the Great Depression. And this, a lot of people lost a lot of money. There's a lot of parallels, actually, between the big electricity companies at that time and companies like Enron more recently. And it led at the time in the 1930s to legislation like the Public Utilities Holding Company Act, which was an attempt to try and stop that sort of thing happening again. And it's ironic, you know, that the Enron episode was only able to occur because Enron got exemption from that act and managed to get the government to deregulate a lot of the laws that would have prevented the whole, you know, episode of the crisis in California and the collapse of Enron from happening again.
You've also got a lot in the book about how the private utilities were major propagandists.
Yes.
Could you talk about a little bit about their public relations campaign?
Well, in defending themselves against the push for public power and for more regulation, the power companies and their umbrella trade organisation, the National Electric Light Association, had a massive propaganda campaign that ran for many years and cost millions of dollars, even at that time, which included all the modern public relations techniques that you can think of today that we often think of as being quite new, including, you know, AstroTurf campaigns. And they did things like they would get women to organise tea parties and invite other women along to these tea parties and just drop into the conversation the topic of ownership of electricity companies and say something like, well, my banker says that public control of electricity companies is just the beginning of socialism or something like this. And the women who went to these tea parties had no idea that it was just all part of a propaganda campaign. They bought newspapers, they ran their own radio stations, you know, they had deposits in every bank in their area in order to have the banks on side. You know, it was just a mess. Oh, the other thing they did was education. They made a special effort to make sure that all the textbooks in schools were pro-private utilities, which, of course, they called public utilities. They changed the language to be on their side as well. They funded universities to make sure that the courses run in universities put forward the private utility point of view. And that was just the beginning. They basically showed the way for future campaigns by the private electricity industry.
And to emphasize the point, even though they claim that they're more efficient because of their private sector nature, in fact, the municipal-owned utilities were actually cheaper and more efficient and offered better service, right?
Yes. You know, the whole claim for private ownership and letting the market take over is supposed to be that, with more competition, you get lower prices and better service, et cetera, et cetera. But if you look both historically and currently if you compare the rates that electricity is sold at for householders, you know, between private and municipal companies, you'll find that the municipal companies offer, in general, on average, cheaper electricity. And we can see more recently that it's more reliable as well, because it's not just New York and California that's suffered blackouts as a result of deregulation. It's happening all around the world where electricity supply is being handed over to private control, where it's being deregulated, restructured, supposedly to make more competition. What's actually happened is that you're getting more blackouts. You've got blackouts in New Zealand, blackouts in South Australia, blackouts in Buenos Aires. You've got rationing in Brazil. You know, everywhere where there's this move for privatisation and deregulation, what's suffering is reliability of supply and also constancy of price. You get huge fluctuations in price as the private companies try to manipulate the market in order to maximise their profits.
I'm speaking with Sharon Bader, who's the author of the book Power Play, The Fight to Control the World's Electricity, just published by the New Press. And just underscoring that point, during the California electricity crisis, the Los Angeles power supply system, which is municipally owned, was completely immune to all the crisis that was affecting the rest of the state. So this is a very dramatic demonstration of the point that the private sector isn't always the most efficient and reliable thing around. But you also point out something that's very important, is that this move to privatize and deregulate electricity really is a worldwide move. And I guess the origin of it was in Thatcher's Britain, right?
Yes. Well, Britain and Chile were the first two places to move towards privatization, and particularly privatization of electricity. And that was, in those countries, it was particularly ideologically driven by people who believed that in small government and using market forces to decide public services. In other countries that have since followed, the drive has been less ideological and more driven by vested interests who see the chance for profit. But the British model, which was followed in California and followed in Australia, was faltered even before the model was followed. So that what was happening in Britain was that price manipulation was already evident before the same power pool system was adopted in Australia and in California. But the lessons weren't learnt because of the power of the vested interests.
Yeah, it's interesting that the reaction to these blackouts or the problems in California is often the problems in the northeastern United States or problems anywhere else in the world, is that the problem is that we just didn't have enough deregulation, or it wasn't done exactly right. There was no, and they use this argument to deflect any critique of deregulation or privatization itself, right?
That's right. That's the spin that's put on it. When deregulation and privatization causes problems that have been, you know, evident everywhere where it's been introduced, instead of saying, well, what lessons should we learn from this, the PR spin that's put on it is, oh, well, it's not the fault of deregulation. The problem is that we haven't deregulated enough and we've got to do more. And the other spin that's often put on it is to blame, for example, environmentalists. You know, that the reason these things have happened is environmentalists have stood in the way of new generation plants or better transmission facilities or whatever. So they look for any reason to... any way to shift the blame from the real cause, which is the deregulation and privatisation, the move to prioritise profits over reliability and affordability.
How did this all get started? It wasn't like there was a great problem with the electricity system. I was annoyed that I had to write a big check to Con Ed every month, but you know, it worked pretty well. And you know, they would give us a blackout every 10 or 20 or 30 years, but you know, basically it worked pretty well. Why did this impetus to privatize, whether republic systems or deregulate in the United States, where did this all come from?
Well, in the United States, part of the problem was the introduction of nuclear power, which caused prices to escalate. Up to that time, economies of scale and introduction of new technology had kept prices falling for many years. But what happened during the 1970s was one, prices started escalating because of the costs of building nuclear power plants, and two, demand didn't increase as much as it had in the past, partly because of conservation. So the private companies, which made a profit from building new power plants, kept building new power plants even though they weren't necessary at the time, and even though the costs of building each one were escalating. And so costs did start going up. And the people who were most concerned about this were the large electricity users, the most intensive electricity users, you know, big industry. And so they were very keen to have a system where new companies could come in that didn't have all these nuclear debts and that could use the new gas technology for producing electricity. And they thought, the big industry thought that they could, you know, bargain with the different companies and get cheaper prices for themselves, even if it was at the expense of the rates for householders. So they were very keen on the whole idea of deregulation. And, of course, there were companies like Enron who could see that they could make profits from trading electricity and being the so-called middleman between the buyers and the sellers.
And, of course, it's in their interest to withhold power, drive up the prices, and make more money that way. They're in this classic monopolist situation.
Yes. I mean, it's the theory is that, you know, if you have competition, and this is what deregulation and privatization was all about, if you have competition, then the companies compete, and they compete by lowering the price, and everyone's better off. But in actual fact, what happens, and it's not just California, it's happened in many states in the U.S., and it's happened all over the world, is that instead of competing by lowering their prices, these companies create, if there's not a scarcity of electricity, they create an artificial electricity by withholding some of their power so as to be able to put up their prices and to manipulate the price, so that what they do is they ensure that demand is high compared with supply, and then they can charge whatever they like.
And, of course, they're the only ones that really have the information on the on the needs for power, the supply and demand situation. So they're perfectly placed to take advantage of the situation.
Yes, they get to know through their daily experience of the market the times when demand is likely to be at its peak, and they experiment with withholding. Excuse me. Withhold, you know, the... They don't have to actually be colluding for this to happen, because particularly when there's low reserve capacity, only one or two companies need to withhold their power, and it causes a scarcity situation. And, of course, that means that there's no incentive for the private companies to have a a decent reserve capacity to prevent that happening, because then they can't charge their high prices. And whilst you're relying on private companies to provide your reserve generation capacity and also your transmission capacity, then you're not going to have enough for emergency situations, which is, you know, the problem that leads to the problems that we've seen recently.
And I love the epigraph you have in Chapter 7 here. If you believe in markets, you can't blanch at the sight of victims, according to Bill Eastlake, who is an economist with the Idaho Public Utilities Commission. If you believe in markets, you can't blanch at the sight of victims. That's really just a wonderful aphorism. I'm going to be quoting that everywhere I go from now on. Have all these disasters led to any kind of rethink, or are we just kind of barreling forward at the same agenda?
What it's meant is it's much more difficult to introduce deregulation and privatisation in places where it hasn't been introduced yet. So, for example, in Latin America and some developing countries, the privatisation proposals are meeting with mass protest. In developed countries that haven't yet privatised or deregulated, like some states in Australia and in Canada, proposals for privatisation deregulation are being met with large voter resistance. In Australia here, we've had governments voted out that have proposed privatisation. So people are learning from experience, even if the politicians aren't, the voters and the citizens are, and they're opposing any further moves as much as they can these days.
But in those places where they've already entered upon the experiment, there's not much of a sign of a reversal.
No, although in California they've had to take a measure of public control back, and there's certainly public sentiment there for more public control of electricity. So I think it's something that will change over time.
All right, well, thank you for joining us, Sharon Bader. And,
thank you, Doug.
Especially at this early hour for you. Sharon Bader is the author of Power Play, The Fight to Control the World's Electricity, and she teaches in the School of Social Sciences, Media and Communications at the University of Wollongong in Australia. And that book, Power Play, just published by the New Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the night. And let's go out with one more from Neutral Milk Hotel.